minute, might say that in this series we were talking about the issues, some of the issues, current issues that we face in the United States, and we mentioned House Resolution 2074, and apparently some of you have written to your congresspeople about this, and I was shown, I haven't had any reply yet, but I was shown two letters from our illustrious leader, Patricia Schroeder. You remember that the House Resolution 2074 has to do with adding in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 the statement, sexual preference, that employers and so on will not be able to practice discrimination against people because of their sexual preference. And then they just define sexual preference as homosexuality, lesbianism, bisexuality, and so on. Well, anyhow, Pat Schroeder wrote back and says, in effect, I'm afraid I am in disagreement with you on this subject. All I'm trying to do is to provide the same rights for all Americans. The issue, as I said, boils down to how the United States is going to define a civil right. And basically, is homosexuality a civil right? That's going to be where the bottom line of this is. There perhaps is another area where there's going to be some debate, and that is in the separation of church and state, in that will they try to force that law on churches so that the homosexual pastors will not be able to be discriminated against, and maybe there the First Amendment will come in conflict if that law gets passed. Now, that law is buried in committee, but it's very live. It's not dead. I shouldn't use the word law. I should use the word resolution. It's buried in committee. They've shuffled it from one committee to another because they realize it's a hot potato in a political year. But you can watch for some action on that resolution, I would imagine, after the election. If any of you others get replies, Tim Worth, et cetera, and some of these others, I'd like to see them, like to have a copy of them for my file. All right, well, you open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and we're going to deal with another issue of the Bible and civil law, and this, of course, relates to believers in litigation against one another. 1 Corinthians 6, we're going to try to handle simply verses 1 through 8 because that covers the burden of the passage. What Paul wants to say, he says it essentially in those verses. Paul, in this section of the book, is dealing with certain problems that had come up in the church at Corinth, and he's going to deal with them individually. For example, there was a man living in incest. Chapter 5 took care of that. In chapter 6, there was quite a bit of litigation that the believers were involved in with one another. In fact, the Corinthians were a very litigious group of people. In fact, all Greeks were very litigious. And so Paul takes that issue up in the first 8, 9, 10, 11 verses. In chapter 7, he deals with marriage problems and so on. And apparently these had been related to him by Chloe. Okay? Okay, the first verse reads this way. Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? 6:1 defines the issue. Defines the issue he's now going to deal with. Okay? Some of you may have a translation for another, neighbor. Dare any of you going, having a matter against a neighbor? That word, regardless of what the translation you're reading, another, has to equal another believer. Another believer. And the way we know that that's for certain is in verse 6. But brother goeth to law with brother. Another way we know that that is the case is that the word unjust is used. Okay? So another means another believer, and the point is litigation between two believers. Okay? The words that are translated in verse 1, go to law, is a translation of the verb krino in the middle voice, and it's an infinitive form here. It's krinestai, or krinestai if you are looking at an interlinear or at a Greek New Testament. So this is the middle form of krino. And krino means to judge. But in the middle form, in some cases, it has a special emphasis. And that special emphasis in the middle, you can, as you know, the middle voice has to do with being intensely involved in the results of the action or in the action itself. Like when you kiss your wife, you're really interested in the results of that action. Or if you hit a golf ball. That's middle voice. And in literary Koine Greek, the middle voice was used as a special emphasis with going to law, or for going to court. Going to court. So though it's the normal verb for judgment, passing a judgment, it's the idea that you're just not getting somebody to pass a judgment, you're actually taking the case to court. You'll find that same concept in verse 6. But brother goes to law. Same verb, middle voice, with brother, and that before unbelievers. And now in verse 7 it says, there is utterly a defect among you because you go to law. Not the same verb, but a noun that means you go to law. So this is qualified also in verse 7 by the word that means go to law. Okay? It's a derivative of that verb. And moreover, the persons that are involved, maybe in terms of helps, maybe the judge, Thayer says that the word following krino, preposition, takes the word for judge. The word unjust would mean the judge, but unfortunately unjust is in the plural, so Thayer didn't mention that. So we have to consider that word. It is before the unjust, and this word is in the plural. Plural. Now maybe he had in mind several judges when he put unjust in the plural. Or maybe he had in mind those involved in the court clerk, maybe those who argued the case and so on, the lawyers and so on. Whatever. This could include judges, clerks, lawyers, etc. And the idea is, now that's qualified for us. We don't have to wonder about that word. That word is qualified in verse 6 again. But brother goeth to law or to court with brother, and that before unbelievers. So this word in the plural meant unbelievers. They were unjust in terms of justification. They attempted to mediate justice from their legal point of view and from the laws, the jurisprudence of their day, but before the Lord, they were unjust, were unbelievers. Okay? Now the challenge is this in the verse. The challenge is this. Dare, verb can be translated dare, or presume, or to have the audacity. To have the audacity. Okay? And so what he's saying to the Corinthians is, do you have the audacity to try to settle some issue that you have against another brother by taking it to a court of law, where there are unjust ones and not to the saints, presume, have the audacity to ask the courts to judge what the saints, believers, could judge. That's the challenge. Okay? You notice it has a question mark in the end. In fact, the first four verses in the critical text are all questions. Every one of them are questions. He's trying to get to them. He's trying to get them to think a little bit more about what they're doing. Okay? Okay. Now what he does in the latter or the, in the rest of the verses is he gives his logic. He tries to establish an argument to circumvent that method of solving disputes. So from verses 2 through 8, he is presenting a logic to circumvent the courts in legal disputes between believers. Okay? Okay, what I'm going to try to do is to follow through the logic of each verse. Do you not know? Are you not aware? And that is simply a way to remind them of something. He uses the word oida, the verb oida, to know, which means, do you not know based on fact or on doctrine that the saints shall judge the world? And the idea is he's simply reminding them of that. So verse 2 is going to follow just a little bit of a logical significance. Saints will judge. Now he just uses the active voice of judge, the cosmos. The saints will judge the cosmos. Okay, we take the question and we turn it into a sentence, a fact. And if the world, or if the cosmos, shall be judged, future passive of the same verb, by you. And it's a first-class conditional sentence, which means he assumes it's true. Assuming it's true that the cosmos will be judged to you, are you not worthy to judge in the smallest? And again, this is that same word we had in Luke a few weeks ago, the leastest, the superlative of least, least, leaster, leastest. Are you not unworthy to judge in the leastest manners? Saints will judge the cosmos. Watch this little syllogism now. Saints will judge the cosmos if, and it is true, if and it is true that saints will judge the cosmos, then taking it and rephrasing it into a declarative sentence, you surely, since this is such a momentous thing, you surely can judge in the leastest, see? Or like the King James says, the smallest matters. Superlative form of a comparative adjective. Now that's a pregnant statement he's making there. It's full, it's loaded. We're going to judge the cosmos. That is our calling and that is our destiny. We're going to reign with Christ in the cosmos. And by the way, if there's nothing in the cosmos to judge, then what will we be doing judging? In other words, if there is not some authoritative or qualitative responsibility in that, then this sentence doesn't mean anything in the Bible. In other words, if the amillennialists are correct, then we don't have any place to fit in. And the judgment matters. But the amillennialists are incorrect. We're going to have lots of room, lots of time to judge because it's going to be during the millennial period. Okay? Okay. And the amillennialists say there isn't any millennial period. It all ends up in one big bang anyhow, and then the unrighteous are separated, and they go into hell, and the righteous go into the everlasting kingdom, and that's the end of it. No, there's going to be a period of judgment in there, time to judge. Okay? Okay. So there's a little syllogistic reasoning there. Surely, if that's the case, compared to the responsibility of the coming age, then current matters that require little discernment are relatively insignificant. Okay? Okay, now he repeats another syllogism in verse 3. And he does it the same way. Know you not that we shall judge angels? And this syllogism runs verse 3 and 4. Okay? So the statement of fact simply is, we, saints, shall judge angels. And this, of course, refers to fallen angels. And somewhere along in that, either in the millennial period or at the end of the millennial period or before we go into the millennium, we're going to be involved in passing judgment on fallen angels. Well, if that is true, then how much more, or the concept of how exceedingly then we have a capacity to judge things in this life. Exactly how we're going to judge angels, we're not told. But the point of the passage is that members of the body of Christ constitute the highest form of created beings in Christ, that is, in their position. As such, they're going to judge angels. Paul says, accept that and then apply it to the circumstances of this life accordingly. The things of this life, let's see, I'd like to get this syllogism up here. We shall judge angels. We are capable of judging things of this life. What would a better translation be? Details of life. Common daily issues of life. Okay? Okay, the word is, that's all one word. That's the translated, the things of this life, or things that pertain to this life, is this word, biotakos, or biotikos, I'm sorry. Sounds like a good word for a new energy food. Get your biotikos for breakfast, and be bio... Well, this refers to the details of life. Okay? That which pertains to life. But the Greeks used the word to refer to business matters also. Okay? Where common sense would prevail. Common sense, business matters. Okay, so we have our two points. And now in the fourth verse, you'll see he does just the same thing he does up here. He'll introduce it with a bit. If, and this is a question in the critical text, if then you have judgments of things pertaining to this life, do you set them to judge who are least esteemed in the church? And the word least esteemed really is a word, ones that are being despised. Ones who are looked upon as being lowly. Those who are sort of no account. But he says they're in the church, so it's a little difficult to say just precisely what he has in mind there, except that they don't have much of a reputation in the church. And the answer to the question would be no. See? So, he is saying, since we are capable, do we choose those of no repute in the church to judge? Question mark. The answer, of course, is no. But the implication is that this is better than choosing some unjust judge. I speak to your shame, verse 5. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brother. In other words, Of course, the thing you would do if you took that in a church situation, you would go to somebody who was had some esteem and had some reputation of knowledgeability, and you would try objectively to present the case to that person. Okay? So verse 4 is probably best translated as a question, as in the New American Standard or the American Standard of 1901. It is possible that you could say, these are the ones you're setting to judge, and put an exclamation point after that. Okay? But the point simply is the same. You have a sort of a syllogistic reasoning. We shall judge angels. We are capable of judging common daily issues. Since we are capable, we would not follow this course of action. It just ends up sort of negative-like instead of positive. Okay? Okay. Verse 5. Here is the wise course of action. And, again, will you notice that it's questions in King James? Paul is trying to stimulate them to action now relative to this litigious attitude that they had. I speak to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able. And there you have the concept of the person is intrinsically capable. He has great capacity to help them come to some decision relative to the case. This reinforces the fact that verse 4 is a question. Is there not one who is able to judge and mediate in the entire fellowship? And the implication is, surely there is. So, putting this in a declarative sentence, surely there is a wise, capable person in the church, okay, to judge, which he feels is a much better course of action. In whatever case he had in mind, whatever the litigation was, he felt that that would be a proper choice. Okay? Verse 6, again, he repeats the issue. But brother goeth to law with brother, or goes to court with brother, and that before unbelievers. And the tense is middle. Brothers, keep going to court. This is durative action. This is not a... You know, everybody that comes to me and asks me about this, I'll ask them a question. When was the last time you took a brother to court? I've never been to court with a brother. That's why I'm having trouble. I don't want to go to court with a brother. I said, you're in good ground. You're in good shape. The problem here was they were continually going to court. Now, I wonder something. And this is true. This was true of practically all of Greece. And Greece was notoriously hedonistic in its mentality at this time. And I'm wondering if when a society degenerates to hedonism, when pleasure, personal pleasure, or selfish pleasure is probably the word I should use, becomes normative in the society, and in which case then you have the character breakdown, the mental breakdown, that goes along with that mentality. I wonder if that isn't always the case, that you have a notoriously litigious society. People will be looking for ways to get money by litigation, by lawsuits. Most of you know, I hope you know, the tremendous problem we have in the United States with this today. One of the reasons the doctor's fees are so high is that doctors have to carry so much insurance. And who's going to bear that? The customer's going to bear that. That's part of capitalism. That has to be passed on to the customer. Do you know now that, I probably shouldn't tell you this. I'll tell you, because none of you would get involved in this. Do you know now, as of this year, that all the denominations are having to carry insurance on their pastors, or they feel they do? because they open up the denomination for litigation because of the counseling of the pastor. They have to carry malpractice insurance on pastors, and they're recommending it across the board for all pastors. I get a monthly publication called Your Church, which is they try to get everybody on the list. And since it's, you don't have to pay for it, well, I get it. And the insurance companies now are running ads in there. Do you have your malpractice insurance? Because you can be sued. We live in a notorious, litigious society, and I'm wondering if in a society where hedonism doesn't take over, that this is just a normal course of things. That's the way it was in Corinth. And it was a persistent thing. You see, it wasn't some remote happening in the church. It was happening all the time. So part of the information that Paul is giving is based on that problem. Okay? Okay. And what he is saying is that there's a problem. Okay? Or that this creates an embarrassing situation for the message of Christianity. And verse 7 sort of helps us with that. Now therefore, there is utterly a fault. That word is, I guess that's okay, but the idea is, you want to get out of that word fault, is the word defect. The concept of a detriment, a wrong that's going to be detrimental to the church. Because you keep going to law. I didn't look at that verb this time. Let me look at that. Yeah. Well, yes, because you keep, the King James says, you go to law, and it's the concept of you are having a legal situation, a legal matter always before you, and the verb is present tense again. See? It was a durative thing. So that meant that there was some defect, some detrimental thing that was happening in the church in their mentality. Okay? So what he does is offer them an option. First he says, there's a detriment. There is a defect. A detriment. And he says it this way, among you. Okay? And that detriment manifests itself, that defect manifests itself. It is manifested by continually, present tense, having, that's the verb, now the noun, lawsuits. Okay. Now he offers an option. Option. Some of the things that they were getting involved with were just ridiculous. Why do you not rather take the wrong or the injustice, the thing that was done to you unjustly? Why do you not rather suffer, passive voice, to be defrauded? So the option was, can take the injustice. You can take the injustice. Okay, that's a possibility. You can suffer silently the defrauding. Okay. But to do that, you would have to decide, you'd have to make a decision as to which would do the greatest harm. If going to court causes greater harm, then you're taking this passive attitude. Now, normally, the Bible does not encourage a passive attitude. It normally encourages an active attitude. But in this case, Paul is saying, here is a possibility. You could take a passive attitude, but you would have to decide which would do the greater harm or cause the most suffering. Going to court or not going to court. Apostle Paul appealed himself to the courts when his life was about to be taken by the Jews. He appealed to the courts. It's a little different situation. Not quite the same in that they were not believers. But nevertheless, he appealed to the courts. Christ appealed to the courts. He appealed for witnesses against him. But this is an option, okay? Okay, now verse 8. Now he really comes at them with a charge. This is the final charge. Nay, you are doing injustice. He takes the same two verbs. Here, these verbs are passive. You are being acted upon. Verse 7. Here you are, we'll make you a woman. And you are being acted upon, and you are getting unjust treatment. Okay? And you are being defrauded. And you are being acted upon. That's verse 7. These are passive verbs. Okay? Now verse 8, he takes the same two verbs and he puts them in the active voice. No, you are practicing injustice is the idea. Which meant that he knew the details of their case and he was judging their case. You see what I'm saying? He is saying, in effect, he's asking them all these questions all the way through. Can't you get somebody in the church to try to decide what the real issues here in this matter is that you have to take to court? Surely you can do that, and he asks him to form a court. Then when he gets down to the end, he judges the matter, see? You are practicing fraud. See? So he pronounces judgment on the basis of the information, apparently, that he got from Chloe. Okay? And it looks like, I'm not sure, it's possible that there was kind of a crossfire going on here, that maybe there was a retaliation situation where one brother sold another brother a car and the right wheel fell off. Or he sold him a toga and it looked like it was nice on the outside, but when the first time he washed it, it fell apart. So he then got back at him by defrauding him. So that might have been going on. Might have been some reciprocal thing. One of our problems with this passage is that we do not know all the details of what was happening in that church. And Paul apparently did because he pronounces judgment on the situation. See? Okay, what I'd like to do, can I answer any questions on the words or anything up to this point? Yeah. Not necessarily. What he's saying is, isn't there anybody that way? Isn't there somebody that way? You notice he uses a plural, set them. Oh no, I'm sorry, they use the single there, singular in verse 4. No, verse 5 is simply asking, he's saying, isn't there even one like that? Mm-hmm. I guess if your church was maybe real small, it might be just one, but there would be several probably. Any other questions we can try to answer? Yes, Doc. In this age, what you do is you sit down and figure out what's going to cost the most. Any other questions on the passage? I'm going to go through in some points and tell you where the way I think that this applies to this age. I'm going to give you my judgment. Okay, I would like to give you some doctrinal points relative to this passage, what the teaching is. Doctrinal points. I have six of these up here, and I may end up with more because sometimes when I'm going through it, you find you have to break down a few more in order to really communicate what you want to say. Number one, this passage does not forbid believers to go to court against other believers. I have heard it said that believers should never go to court. And they point to this passage and they say, this passage forbids believers ever to go to court. It doesn't do that. What does it do? Point two. The passage does encourage believers to resolve civil suits through mediation in the church. And the idea would be, Paul doesn't say that you're going to be able to resolve the thing every time. He just intimates that that's possible. And apparently, in the cases that they had, he felt that that was possible. The passage does encourage believers to resolve civil suits through mediation in the church. I noticed Vic just left. He's our lawyer. This is a hard passage on him. There are one of the differences that we have today is that law is much more complex today. And you could get yourself in a legal jam yourself in the church today if you gave advice that was contrary to law. That could happen. For example, in some, I know some people, not in this church, they were working on a divorce. I mean, you really have to work on a divorce, I want to tell you, if you have money. And they were working on it. And it was a husband and wife, and they were both believers. And I don't know how many millions of dollars the guy had. And they both came to me, one at a time. They would fly in here for me to try to help them with the issue. I want to tell you, there isn't a guy, well, maybe Vic could, and his lawyer team. Maybe they could solve that tangle of money and the way it was invested and try to split it up. But I wouldn't even attempt to even think about it. It'd be totally impossible. I wouldn't even know the legal ramifications of it. That's how complex it was. It was millions and millions of dollars tied up in the various kinds of investments and so on, properties and so on. The passage encourages believers in the church to try to resolve some common issues that people have that you don't have to take into court. I had a case where the church that I was in before I came to this church, there was a man who had borrowed some money from a guy who was in this church. Okay? And after I was here about a year, this person that was in his church made an appointment to see me. And he says, I want to explain the situation to you. And he gives me the essential facts. Lent this guy some money X number of years ago. Supposed to have it paid back in such a way, prescribed length of time, certain amount of percentage. He had a contract, showed me the contract. It's all signed, everything was legal. And he said, I haven't been able to get him to pay it. And I said, well, you know the pastor over there, don't you? And he says, yeah, I do. I says, why don't you get the pastor over there and see what he thinks and see if you three can get together. He says, I've already done that. He says, the pastor had told the guy, yeah, that's right. It's all legal. You should pay him back. You know, do whatever's necessary. And the guy said, it hasn't worked. And this has been going on now for 3 years. I don't have a dime on it. What do you think I should do? I said, take it to court. I don't think you're going to get your money any other way. Or, you have the option of verse 7. You take it on the chin, and you just mark it off as a fraud, and you forget it. Strike it out of your mentality. Passage encourages believers to resolve civil suits through mediation in the church, but it doesn't say what you're going to do if that fails. See what I'm saying? Okay. A major difference, this is point 3. A major difference today, between today and that day, is that in that day, there was one local church. Today, there are hundreds of local churches. Now, if those two men had been in this same assembly that I'm talking about, the one I'm referring about, I mean, that probably would have gotten spread around through the fellowship, and nobody else would have lent that one fellow any money, unless you would have been an idiot. He wouldn't have had a chance to practice that fraud again. Maybe he'd have a chance somewhere else to practice it again, you see. But it couldn't have happened here. Why? Because Why is there a difference? Because today there are hundreds of local churches. And somebody does something wrong in one and they get their feathers ruffled or they get challenged about it, they just tromps off to somebody somewhere else as though nothing happened. That could not have been done in Paul's day. Okay? Fourthly, civil suits, and this is part of the doctrine of the passage, civil suits between believers can be a disgraceful spectacle to unbelievers. That's certainly plausible. And most likely there is going to be one party at fault. Now maybe there's a misunderstanding between two believers in terms of what a contract meant. You see, maybe you could get into that situation. In which case, it would take a court maybe to settle it, or if you were to ask somebody in the church, they could probably let the men know what their options are, and that's about as far as they could go. Then the men would have to decide how they were going to solve it if they were going to try to do it in the church. But you could get into a very disgraceful spectacle before unbelievers, and this is what Paul, of course, is trying to prevent. The fifth point of doctrine, and we've already mentioned this in from verse 7, Paul does leave an option. And the option is to bear the fraud rather than going to court. But there is a criteria on this. Criteria. And the criteria is, which will be the less harmful? Which will be the less harmful? You take the lesser of two evils, so to speak. Which will be the less harmful? Going to court with the case, suffering the fraud, taking the case to the church. And it's very obvious, of course, in the whole passage that Paul is trying to eliminate as much disgraceful spectacle before unbelievers that he can. Point 6, and we've mentioned this along the way. The Greeks were notorious litigious. The believer is not to be of that bent. And like I say, if somebody asked me about this, I always ask them, when was the last time you took another believer to court? Just to see if there's some kind of a pattern in the person's life. As I see it, those are six major doctrinal considerations that one should come away with from this passage, understanding some of the background of it. There may be others that you might think of. Is there anything anybody has a question about or something we could add to the concepts? Anybody have any questions about any of the verses? Paul is not saying that you couldn't get justice from the courts in those days. He willingly submitted his life to the courts. He was very willing to try the system or to go through the system. You could get a form of justice. But you would expect that in among believers that you would have a higher standard of morality and a higher sensitivity toward morality than what you could find in the courts. And so there was a certain element of logic, because believers were going to have such a tremendous responsibility to judge in the future. Surely they could judge in some of these small matters of the day. And I think that's kind of indicative of the kind of cases that he was talking about. Well, I'm through. Unless there's a question. Yes, Dave? Well, it is, except that the two things that he's comparing are different. In other words, you notice he follows the statement by how much more the biotikos, the things of this life. We will be prepared, as you say, to judge angels by by change. We won't have a sin nature, of course. But that parallelism holds true in terms of that biotikos concept. You've got to realize he is not talking about some enormously complex legal situation here. He's talking about something that's simple and you can make a judgment over pertaining to this life. If you signed a contract with somebody, it's very obvious that you're supposed to keep the word and keep the contract, that type of thing. So in a sense, the parallelism does hold true because he keeps it on that level by the word biotikos. And you notice he follows it up by saying, if then we have judgments of biotikos, that kind of judgment. Any other? Well, there's an enormous amount of material on essentially what I wanted to cover. And when I come back, I think we're going to deal with eschatology in this hour. I'll be gone for 2 Sunday nights. I hope you'll support those that are teaching and ministering while I'm gone. Shall we close in prayer? We do thank you, our Father, that you have given us the capacity through the understanding of your word and the study of the truth, the doctrine that you have in your word, to judge things pertaining to this life. We pray that this study will be beneficial and helpful in the days ahead for each of us who are believers in Christ's name.
Amen.